Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey friends, welcome to the Tennis and Bagels podcast. I am Andre, and we're here at the beginning of the clay court season in tennis, which is really exciting. I really love clay. Brazilian, I grew up playing on clay courts. I've talked about this a lot during this podcast lifetime. And I am, of course, following the Monte Carlo tournament, and I'm excited for what's coming next. Federer is due to play soon, and I can't wait. And I am obviously here joined by my wonderful co-hosts, Vansh and Owen. How are you guys doing today?
Fantastic, Andre. Good to be back talking about the first Clay Court Masters 1000 tournament that just took place in Monte Carlo. And excited to get into it, and excited for what's to come the rest of the clay court season. A lot of great stories.
Yeah, always great to be here, and this should be fun because our preview podcast was fun, and basically right after we recorded it, a bunch of stuff went down. So this should be a fun follow-up.
Including one of them, which was the most unexpected. Like, props to you for ever able to predict something. Please tell me the lottery numbers, but like Medvedev getting COVID, unbelievable. Like, nobody would have ever expected it, and especially because it was a draw that could have helped him like get something going, because it was it wasn't as complicated of a side of a draw. Shame for him. He's not going to be able to play, and hopefully he gets to play soon, because I think he has to quarantine for 2 weeks after testing positive, and has to test negative, I think, twice. There's a whole protocol for him to play. Hopefully he gets to play some good matches and win a couple before the French, which comes pretty fast, honestly. Clay court season is not incredibly long, even though he has a bunch of good and important tournaments. But yeah, back to Monte Carlo. What do you guys think? Let's just roll with it, like in a, as if like we're on the round table, we're just speaking of the tournament that just happened. No podcast, no nothing, just fan talks. What do you guys think of the tournament?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Medvedev getting COVID. That was pretty unfortunate, because his two best results in 2019 were Monte Carlo and Barcelona. He's not going to be able to play either, unfortunately. But once that went down, then we had Djokovic and Nadal both lose before, or Nadal losing in the quarterfinals, Djokovic losing to Dan Evans in the round of 16. And this kind of really opened up the door for the two guys who didn't take their opportunity in Miami when there was no big three. We pointed out that those two guys are, you know, probably the next two guys, apart from Medvedev and Thiem, obviously, and Zverev too. But like those two guys who lost to Hurkacz in Miami now had a big opportunity to, you know, take advantage of their sections and get through. And the winner at the end was a very deserving winner, and Stefanos Tsitsipas, who's had a great pedigree so far on clay and just kept building and building. He's now number one in the race. He's the most consistent player this season. Reached quarterfinals or better at every single event. And he really made it to the final fairly easily, especially after Djokovic lost that match to Dan Evans. But we can talk about Djokovic and Nadal later. What impressed me was just Tsitsipas, the way he was able to just seize the moment and then handle the pressure this time around. But this time it was his third Masters 1000. He'd been to one in 2018 in Canada, Toronto, And he beat Djokovic, but lost to Nadal and beat a couple other top 10 players. And then he also beat Nadal in Madrid in 2019, but then lost to Djokovic in the final. And so now he was able to take advantage, and he and Rublev have had a decent rivalry so far. They played 5 or 6 times, and, you know, and now Tsitsipas has got the better of Rublev in their last 2 clay court meetings. And so at the end, it was quite a one-sided, I'd say a good final, but it was, I never felt like the result was really in doubt. I don't know. How about you, Owen?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I'll say all my predictions sort of fell very flat. I said I was expecting and looking forward to a Nadal-Djokovic final, which obviously didn't happen, but I think there were plenty of interesting storylines to follow. I was really happy for Tsitsipas. He didn't beat Djokovic or Nadal, but he played by far his best match of the tournament, I thought, in the final. Really stifled the best parts of Rublev's game while making use of the best parts of his. He kept Rublev moving wide on both wings. His forehands did a lot of damage. He was hitting it with more spin than Rublev. Served incredibly well, I think. I counted 11 unreturned serves for him in the first set. I think Tennis Channel said 10. Either way, it's a huge number. Never faced a break point. And I think Rublev had quite a good week as well. He beat Nadal, which speaks for itself. Played really impressively in that match, broken 7 times, which I think is the most Nadal's been broken since he lost to Fognini at the US Open. And Rublev impressed me the most when he beat Batista Agut in a really, really physical match. So I think both these guys should come away feeling very good. What you said, Vonch, about Tsitsipas making a Masters 1000 finals before, I was happy for him that he was able to sort of instantly seize on this chance that wasn't against a big three member. I think we've seen players sort of falter a bit when the big three aren't in play. You talked about it with Miami and how Rublev and Tsitsipas sort of stumbled a little bit, realizing that they could be called the favorites. But here, Tsitsipas totally took his chance. He was the favorite going into the final, I thought, and he absolutely played like it. He never doubted himself, and he was rewarded with quite a one-sided victory in the final. So I think going forward, he's quite a huge threat in all the events of the clay season. I've seen takes saying he could be considered the third favorite for Roland Garros, and I think we'll have to see how team does in his comeback. But yeah, like for right now, he can just bask in the glory of this moment, I think.
Yeah, and the celebration at the end was quite wonderful to see, especially how much it meant to him and exquisite. Just how much of a exquisite. Yes. that was funny what ATP posted, but regardless, and the ceremony speech when he just keeps talking. It's like just says whatever he was saying, but to it was wonderful, joyous, obviously, to listen and watch. But it's like he kept talking with commas and didn't know when to pause. But it was great. Like, he even thanked the photographers, which I loved. He's like, "Your guys' shutter clicks make this tournament so special," or something like that. And as the interesting part was, is that his mom won this tournament 40 years ago or something. Really? But it was a juniors. Wow. Girls tournament at the time. Okay. And so her name is on the country club walls at Monte Carlo. And so it was a very special moment for him and his mom and his whole team and everybody, the whole family was there. And this he said he's been coming here since he was 5 or 6, and he's been watching all the Federer and Nadal finals, like in the crowds. And so now he can finally say that he's a Masters 1000 champion and a very well-deserving one. So It was a great week for him. And now he's going to play Barcelona next week, and we'll see how much he can carry that momentum. But yeah, the French Open is really the goal, I think.
Yeah. I mean, Barcelona is this week, right?
Yeah.
All right, cool. Man, there's a lot of name dropping. First of all, we had like Hurkacz, you had Rublev, Nadal, Djokovic. And you guys can skip on that with fun. But like, honestly, like, I think once you mentioned that on Twitter about Hurkacz, on how like there was the pressure of coming off of as a massive 1000 champion. Mm-hmm. And Hurkacz had 2 things this week. Obviously, he lost in the second round, I think.
That lost to Dan Evans.
Yeah, the mm-hmm. loss to Dan Evans, who was actually playing really well.
Had a great week, yeah.
But very interestingly, how this week was very quiet for him. Almost pun intended, because of his press conference. which was a little weird. But yeah, do you guys think it's something about her catch, like just for like a minute assessment of his performance? Do you think it's a clay court thing for him to like not be able to follow through, or is it just because actually the pressure came in and he just kind of had a low point right now?
I don't think it's a clay thing. I think the week after you win a tournament, or the tournament after you play, when you've just won one, I sort of look at that almost with a half asterisk, because I think there's going to be physical and mental fatigue. Yeah. I think it's tough to have that quick of a turnaround after the biggest win of your career. So if these results continue, then I would say maybe worry about it. But as of now, I don't think this is...
Especially against Dan Evans, right? So stable and consistent on court.
Yeah, and I mean, Evans had quite a good week, so...
It was not concerning for me, especially because like Owen just mentioned, like the mental bounce back ability you need, especially when you're changing surfaces. And it was just, you know, basically 10, 12 days after, and he didn't have a whole lot of time to prepare, I don't think, on the clay. And, you know, he won his first round match against a decent clay court player in three sets. And then he lost to Dan Evans, who had a brilliant week and beat Djokovic and Goffin and Lajovic after that. So it's like he... it's not something I worry about for him. I think we'll follow his results more closely now because he's a Masters 1000 champion. And so his name will be brought up a lot more, which I think will tell us a lot more. The press conference situation was a bit weird and sad. I honestly don't know fully what went wrong with it, why journalists couldn't come up with, you know, one question just on the fly, at least. But he took it really well and actually answered a few of our questions on Twitter, which was great to see.
Yeah. I wonder if every journalist just had their microphones on mute by accident simultaneously.
I think it's good that we're talking about this. From what I heard, I think the journalists knew that he was coming because he had been requested, but they didn't know when he was coming. And the communications department like goofed on that, but I still think they should be a little embarrassed that they couldn't come up with a question on the fly, because it would have been very easy. I think they could have like raised their hand and bought a few extra seconds that way. So I think it was a shame that happened, and a really classy move by Hurkacz that he took to Twitter to answer a couple of questions, because people do have questions for him.
Yeah, especially like young guys, they're pretty active on social media, a few of them, right? So that's cool. And people tend to ask really good questions on Twitter too, so why not? So speaking of, I want to talk maybe more, let's go from Rublev perspective, because he's runner-up, right? So like let's go from there right now. What did you think of his Nadal match? I guess like if you want to speak from that would be probably the match of the week, if you will, like for in terms of importance, like Nadal losing on clay is always an event to remember, an event to consider.
I think two things happened here. Yeah. Firstly is that Nadal struggled, obviously, big time with his serve. He called it after a match, a disaster. I think he hit seven double faults in a set and a half. And like Owen said, he was broken seven times. And, you know, he obviously can play in any clay court conditions, like he's proven a million times in the past.
Including Roland Garros 2020.
Exactly. Perfect example. And, you know, and the conditions were kind of cold and slow, and he wasn't getting the same effect on the ball as much. And I just thought his overall game, just parts of it were just off. And that happens when you have a bad serving day. I think he even mentioned after that it was kind of a trickle down effect for the rest of his game, that he wasn't able to, you know, sustain rallies and keep Rublev out of his comfort zone, which is that forehand wing. And credit to Rublev, because he really took advantage of all this, and he hit some great returns, especially on the backhand. He, kept Nadal honest by hitting backhands down the line, which, you know, most often we talk about players with righties, two-handers, who can take that ball early on the rise and they can just crush it cross-court flat and hard into the Nadal forehand and hope for some kind of payoff. And Nadal wants you to go into these cross-court patterns on clay where he has a little bit more time, and then he can open up the court with his forehand and stretch you all over the place. And then the match is more or less on his racket, especially when he's not serving like the way he was. As poorly, but instead Rublev was able to take that time and hit it really hard and pin Nadal in his backhand corner and then get forehands out of it and move Nadal around that way. And he also showed some few instances of variety on his own, where he came up with drop shots, pushed Nadal back, and won a couple of the long rallies as well. And he was holding his own on his protecting his second serve much better than you would have expected. And all these things kind of played into it. And it almost looked like it was going to be over in two sets if Nadal didn't get something going. But then there was this one point where Rublev hits this approach shot to Nadal's forehand at 4-3 add out. And Nadal is anticipating, and it's one of those brilliant shots, but we've seen Nadal do that so many times that, you know, Rublev should have known better, honestly, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I don't think that should be a matter of opinion. And I'd just like to add really quickly, Tennis TV made a video of like top 10 shots and rallies from the tournament. Can you guess where this point was ranked?
Number one,
which is absolutely absurd. Tennis TV, if you're listening to this, shave up.
The one thing about that shot for me is like, and it's something that I've noticed a little bit in Rublev, and we were talking a little bit in the pre-recording session of this podcast. Rublev has a little bit of a mechanic to this game, and to his game rather, and he tends to have very, very foreseeable shots coming. Like, as soon as you see the image of like Rublev with that, as soon as I saw that image with Rublev like on that forehand, I knew he was going to go inside out. And Nadal probably just looked at it and was like, he's just going inside out. Of course, he had the tough job of putting that ball back in a way that was going to go like not just kind of like a wimpy little shot that was just going to go back to another short shot so that Rublev could finish the point. He had a work to do, but he knew that the shot was going there. So he had time to think about it and just try to like position himself in a way that he would give himself a chance of hitting that shot. But yeah, it's like it's something that Rublev may want to consider a little bit more, just a little bit more court awareness, like understanding like where his opponents are and where he is at. He hits really good shots from the ground, like unbelievable. Maybe sometimes he can direct those shots a little bit better. That's my only concern. Well, not my only concern about Rublev, but like if he's going to keep his play this way, just hammering shots and playing with high intensity and a lot of pace on his shots, maybe he wants to consider just placing them a little bit better. But
I agree with that, Andre, but what was impressive after that is that when Nadal took that set 6-4, and you're thinking, okay, it's probably going to be a runaway set here, maybe 6-2, 6-3, something like that, for Nadal. But it didn't happen that way. Rublev was able to reset really quickly, and that's the most impressive set I probably would have ever seen. I could easily say that's the most impressive set of his career so far, and I wouldn't be completely wrong. And so I think, and Nadal obviously gave him opportunities, and he didn't play his best. But then they exchanged breaks, and it was 1-1. And then I thought, okay, maybe it's going to be a little bit more even, but Nadal will find a way. He'll pull through.
Yeah.
But then Rublev hit some incredible returns, and he started doing the same thing, pinning Nadal back in the backhand corner. And Nadal was just frustrated. And I've never seen Nadal like, you know, show his emotions that outwardly, like he was doing, like his hands on his hip or like, you know, things like just looking at his box or just like frustrated.
There was a big scream early in the match.
Yeah. And you know, just so emotive. And I don't know if he was just a little bit, just feeling a little bit flat, and he needed to let some of that out. But in general, his serving just never got better, even after that. And it's just he was making a lot of unforced errors too off his backhand wing that were surprising. And I think I saw after the match he had 36 unforced errors, and 19 of them were off the forehand, and maybe like 13 or 14 off the backhand. And his and so it just shows that like Nadal, the last two seasons, there's a separation between his results before the French Open and at the French Open. And I think that's just natural. With age, you want to peak. Both these guys, Djokovic and Nadal, are looking to peak at the majors. Yeah. And we're starting to see now that these best of three set matches, even on the clay, are more open. And, you know, I'll be very surprised if Nadal and Djokovic play like this, let's say 3-4 weeks from now. Like I'd be shocked. I think they're going to be much, much harder to stop.
I think that's really well said. I was only able to see the first half of the Rublev Nadal match, but Rublev did do a great job of pinning Nadal in his backhand corner. He used the backhand down the line well, an element of his game that wasn't really as present in the final. And I think Nadal hit almost all of his double faults in the first half of the match, but Rublev was doing damage off the return, both off the second serve return and the first serve return. And I I mean, I think Nadal played badly overall, no question about that, but he actually played a few very good points. Like when he had time on the forehand, he was doing ridiculous things with it, like always, but he just couldn't string enough of those points together. And I was really impressed to see that Rublev came back and won the third set, because he was very close to going up a double break, I think in two games in the second set. And there were some points where Nadal saved them with winners, or where he got a little lucky off a Rublev error. But it's really, really impressive to regroup like that, because Nadal had never lost a third set at Monte Carlo before. Exactly. And Rublev beat him decisively here. So.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned that. When I was looking at the scoreline, Rublev won two sets at 6-2, but he could have been straight set to 6-2 because he had a break point. He had break point chances at 4-2 in the second set. He ended up losing that set 6-4 instead. But yeah, in terms of importance for maybe Rublev, this tournament obviously seems to have been a really good tournament for Rublev. He was really tired, obviously. Not obviously, but like he was most likely very tired by the end to face a pretty much fresh Tsitsipas. He hadn't had to face an extremely difficult opponent until the final. But in terms of going forward for Rublev, what do you guys say on this?
I just like to say really quickly, I don't know how tired he was in the final, because he did have a pretty comfortable semi. But go ahead, Fonch.
But I mean, on that, it was impressive to me that he, almost equally as impressive, that he was able to back that up against a very good clay court player in the semifinals.
Yeah,
Casper Ruud, who's made now two semifinals at Masters 1000 level in a row, at Rome 2020 and then also now here. And that was a little bit more of a comfortable matchup for him than I had expected, because Ruud hits a big ball, especially off the forehand, and his forehand is like, you look at him, you're like, this is a proper clay court player. But he was able to come back from a breakdown in the second set from 4-2 down, and then won that second set 7-5. And so he was able to conserve a little bit of energy there and not have to go to a third set, which some people were expecting, honestly, that it would go three sets. But he was able to get out of that. And I think it was just, he was just outclassed in the final, to be honest, by a better clay court player than him. But it was a phenomenal week for him, because he showed that he's physically a lot tougher now too, because he played that really impressive match against RBA, which quality-wise might have been the best match of the week, along with I think that probably was the best match. And then to back that up and then beat Nadal and then here. So I think it goes well for him. And he joked afterwards that he actually took a wild card to play. He said he was really exhausted, but then somebody asked him, "You're playing in Barcelona. So what's up with that? Like, I thought you were exhausted." And then he's like, "Well, you know, I took a last minute decision for a wild card there Thursday, just before I was going to play Nadal, because I thought I'm going to be on my way there." and so he didn't expect to be playing the final here on Sunday, but he's like, "You know what, now I'm signed up and it's not too long of a flight, so I'll just head over there and just see what happens." But no, like, regardless of that, I think in general, like, Rublev's been winning a lot, but it never really changed my opinion of him, because I still always thought, like, okay, it's what we expect, you know, he's beating everybody he's supposed to. And then, but now he finally has that one signature win that he can really point to, and it's a big one. And so I think that just bodes well for his confidence and belief moving forward. And also, he's aware of the fact that he can be exposed at times against these top players, and that his game needs a little bit more developing and dimensions to it, if you will. And I think he's aware of that, but he also knows how good his strengths are. And so for him, it's going to be about adding those little extra elements, like the touch, the net play. You know, even if he doesn't do it, the variety, I just think sometimes his defense can get a little bit better, and maybe the second serve for sure. And then just finishing points at the net, because you have to have a, especially on clay, I think on hard court, he can rush Tsitsipas, or he can rush players with one-handed backhands and then come to the net and hit swing volleys and then be very successful at finishing points in the midcourt. But on clay, he's going to need to add that extra layer of finishing touch, whether it be through drop shots or short slices, or, you know, like those backhand volleys in the open court that you have to knife. So shots
which he missed one really badly against Tsitsipas during the final. Open court, a volley. Net play is definitely something that he would want to work on. If not for the clay season, at least like coming back to grass and hard courts where he excels. Mm-hmm. So yeah, those are stuff that he needs to work on, I believe too.
And I think the net play is pretty pressing, because he's ranked quite highly right now. But if he wants to go up, he needs to learn not just to be an offensive player, but how to be successfully offensive against great defenders. And these great defenders are going to make him hit multiple volleys. And that is just not a sustainable way for him to win points, given the touch he has. So he needs to be able to knife those volleys, like you said, Bonch. He needs to be able to put away overheads consistently. He needs to be able to hit drop volleys. Because if he can't do that, he'll be able to control plenty of points, but he won't always be able to finish them. And that's a gut-wrenching way to lose points. It can influence matches. So I think if he wants to go up to the next level, this is definitely something to address.
And the dry volley is actually kind of a good segue into the match that he played against Tsitsipas and obviously the winner of this tournament. There was one thing that I wanted to ask maybe before you guys go into the analysis of his match, or we'll take it as you want it. But do you think this Masters 1000 tournament is more important to him than the NITO ATP finals that he won?
I mean, in terms of points, no. But I think I said on Twitter in a conversation with Mert that he can definitely use it as a better springboard because he did not build on the momentum from winning the ATP finals. He started 2020 pretty slowly. So I think if he has a great clay season, in retrospect, this may end up being a bigger jump in his career than winning the World Tour finals was. What do you think, Mont?
Yeah, I mean, I think he beat bigger names there, and it was a very impressive route there that he beat, you know, Federer and Thiem and Zverev and Medvedev and players like that. But here, I think he can use this really as a launching board, and this could be the start of something big for him, especially for clay seasons to come, and cement his place as the third or fourth favorite, depending on how Thiem looks at the French. And now he's had some big results at every clay court event. And so now, this was really just a validation. His first Masters 1000 was coming. It was more of as an if, but not when, you know what I mean? And so I think he could really use this as a springboard, and he's now number one in the race. And he could, how long he can keep this up. And then I'm interested to see how he does on grass. He's made a fourth round of Wimbledon in 2018, but that was back when he was still very young, just not even 20 yet. And that was before his Canada run. And last year, 2019, when Wimbledon was played, he was coming off that really, that harrowing loss for him against Stan Wawrinka, where he had so many break points. And it was a great match, probably the best match. I think the best match of 2019, in my opinion, that fourth round against Wawrinka. But it was a loss that he's really had to, he's had tough losses and tough moments where he's been up and hasn't converted. And, you know, if you think of the match against Chorich at the US Open, or you think of even the Hurkacz match where, you know, he was the favorite, he should have won, he had leads and things like that. But he's used those experiences and he's built on them, and he's improved little by little, I think, in every department. And he's just becoming a more well-rounded player, I think. And he's now the next step is the major results. He's had three major semifinals now. If he can back that up and do another one or go even further at Roland Garros, and then somehow put together a good run. The tricky part about Wimbledon for him will be the return of serve. I think that'll be much tougher on grass. Yeah. And also just getting used to, if he goes deep at Roland Garros like we expect him to now, he's going to have very little time to adapt to the grass and adapt to those. You have to get used to moving and playing on the surface and kind of build up those miles and matches. And he's not going to be able to get so many matches in, realistically. And so that'll be a challenge for him. Like it's been with Thiem. I mean, it was a challenge for Nadal too, but he figured out a way to overcome it quite early in his career, actually. But then, so now the question is, can he, do it? Do what I was saying on Twitter is like, if he can do like a semifinal of all four majors in the next couple of years, that would be really, really big for his future and his prospects. Mm-hmm. And I forget sometimes he's only 22. He's actually younger than Rublev, which could be surprising to look at for the first time. Like you wouldn't have thought that he's a whole year younger, but so yeah, I think his tennis is in a really good place right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with all that. And I think, he said in an interview, either at the end of last year or the start of this year, I forgot who it was with, but it was on Zoom. He said, like, my goal this year is to beat Rafa at Roland Garros. And when I heard that, I thought he was crazy. And I still don't think it's going to happen. But he has beaten Nadal at the Australian Open from two sets down. He's beaten it all on clay, and now he's won a Masters 1000 on clay. And so I don't think he's crazy anymore, even if I don't think it's going to happen. And I think he has the potential to do really, really well at Roland Garros. He made the semis last year, and he was a set away from the final. So I think even if he doesn't win, this is a great opportunity to like make the semifinals and give absolute hell to whoever he plays, even if he doesn't win, or maybe make a final, particularly if he's in Djokovic's half. So I totally agree that his stock has gone up a lot. And now is the time for him to think, okay, I need to build on this. I think he's playing Barcelona as well, right?
Yeah, he is.
Yeah, so I think, I think like we were saying before, like with Hurkacz, I won't be surprised if he loses early. I don't expect him to win. But after that in Madrid, I will really be watching to see how he does. And I think he should be trying to back up this result as much as he can, trying to build his aura, trying to make other players not want to play him. And I think, yeah, this is the best possible way he could have started the clay season. I think this may be his best surface. So I'm really excited to see where he goes from here.
Yeah. I think it's his best surface. And I'm just excited about the matchups, like just the the prospect of like a healthy, fully fit firing Dominic team against
Tsitsipas. I was just thinking that,
yeah.
Oh, exactly. That'd be so good.
It's interesting too, because like you think of those two guys, and here's a part of their game which you don't necessarily associate that much with the clay courts, which is just the one-handed backhand. But I guess especially for Tsitsipas, it works so much more in his favor to be on clay. For team, obviously he's such a powerhouse that he can hit like his backhand no matter what surface. Maybe he's still trying to find his range on grass a little bit, but like regardless. Just the fact that he has time, both of those guys have time to wind up his their backhands and just like charge up and like put themselves in position and hit like a clean shot. Lots of topspin, lots of power, lots of angles, and it just can do anything. You know, like there was this one shot in that we were just discussing earlier too about there was this passing shot down the line. Tsitsipas hit. He was pretty far back on the court as well too. Yeah. So that passing shot is really fantastic.
His combinations and packages are very good on clay. Like his defense is very good. He can equally defend and attack.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
And he can use variety, and he has a good understanding of how to like push players back and then step in and then come to the net and use his forehand. His forehand is such a weapon on clay. Yeah.
He's really good at turning around points as well.
There's a point I remember distinctly from the final where Rublev was like bullying him around, but Tsitsipas was defending. And then he came up with this great cross-court forehand on the defense, and it pushed Rublev really wide. And Rublev got it back, but then Tsitsipas just pounced on the return and hit a winner down the line off the forehand. And that was just, I think I wrote that it was like, it must have been demoralizing for Rublev, because Tsitsipas like showcased his entire baseline strength in that. He defended well. And then the transition attack like right away. So he's so dangerous when you give him time. His biggest weakness, arguably the return, especially off the backhand, is blunted on clay because he has more time. So this is playing on clay is probably as close to tennis heaven on earth as it can get for him.
Yeah. I think about the statement about like beating Rafa on clay. When you said it, the first thing that I thought, like it was actually probably, it seems like a good symbolic goal to have, like in a sense, like if you think of any surface and you want to beat the one guy on any surface, like you can think Roger Federer on grass, or you can think Novak Djokovic on hard, but it always seems like beating Nadal on clay is definitely the ultimate surface goal that you may have, honestly. And considering, well, he didn't actually get to beat Nadal on clay this tournament, but like he did win his first Masters 1000, and he's showing just how good he is on clay. I think this is his first title of the year too, which says a lot as well. And I think going forward to Roland Garros, and even in his own mind, I think Tsitsipas growing more confident and more comfortable and even more comfortable probably saying, clay is my best surface and I like playing here, which is always something that is good, because it's important to feel at home when you step on the court. It's important to feel like you belong there. It's important to feel like this is my turf. Of course, this is my dirt, if you will, for clay courts. So maybe now it's not as much more of a symbolic statement as it is probably an actual goal. Because you could say, like, my goal this year is to beat Nadal on clay, as in, like, I want to get as close as possible to, like, challenging. But you could say, like, maybe by next year I'll be able to beat Nadal on clay. But I am seriously thinking that he could have a shot. He would still be the underdog. Nadal on clay on Roland Garros and best of five is still a whole different beast to tame. But he did it on hard on Australian Open, arguably Nadal's worst slam, but that's another topic for another talk. But yeah, I think things are shaping up really nicely for Roland Garros, I think.
Yeah, I think it does speak well of him in that respect that he is such a difficult goal, because in men's tennis, I think it is the hardest thing to do. Beat Nadal at the French, two guys have done it ever. Nadal didn't play well in either match. So the fact that this is what he's striving for means that his aspirations are very high, his drive is very powerful, and he clearly believes that he can do it. So like you said, Andre, I think maybe it's not achievable right away, but he is getting himself closer. So I think step one is getting himself to that match, whether it be in a semi or a final. Or maybe a quarter, because I think Tsitsipas is ranked fifth right now. But yeah. And then so step two would be just like putting up a good fight. I think like strip it down into like very achievable goals, like maybe get a set, maybe get two sets if he's able to play that well. And then that's something to build off of, because like Vaughn said earlier, he's young, he's 22. He has plenty of time. No one is going to expect him to win the French this year. And so he can, so in that way, maybe he can play without pressure and just make it as far as he can, and then outpace that the year after and the year after.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have much to really add. So.
what did you think of his tournament then, Vansh? Like what was his level of play? How'd you rate it?
I would say it's, he looked like he had this intensity in his eye. Like I could see it right from, honestly, after he beat Karatsev. I could just tell, like, he was sensing that this was his time. He just looked so comfortable and just so, you know, at place in Monte Carlo. He lives there. He's got a really good, obviously he has this passion for tennis, but it just seems like everything just kind of clicked for him. And you know, I think what was also striking is in the beginning, he was, he had a moment with an umpire in his doubles match with Petros Tsitsipas, and they had a bit of an incident. They won that match, but a line call went against him, and he told the umpire to go back to the futures. And that comment was very out of line and quite frankly a bit disgusting to watch. And he rightfully got a lot of flack for it, and you know, a lot of people were not liking what they were seeing because of the disrespect and the whole tone of it, and the way he did it was just wrong. But then, so we saw that side of Tsitsipas, but then we saw the really good side by the end of the week, and we saw why he's such a great player and so popular. And so, you know, he's an interesting guy, really, I think, on and off the court, and, you know, very philosophical, very just kind of lets you in, a different kind of personality, you know, intriguing. I think he'll be able to bring a lot more fans that don't necessarily follow tennis week in and week out. And he already has such a big fan base from what I can see on social media. And so yeah. I think he's an interesting player to follow. And I also know that Gustavo Kuerten is a big fan of his game, and he likes his one-handed backhand. And he like a lot of players born, you know, like, how do you say, those old school tennis players who are playing in the 90s and 80s. I think they all like his game and his style and personality. So I think from that standpoint, he's going to do, I have a lot of faith in his clay court game, and I have a lot of faith in that he's going to remain a top five player for a good amount of time, I'd say. And maybe I also think that he may not be the first to win a slam out of Medvedev and Zverev and Tsitsipas, but he's certainly up there in the conversation, and that, you know, he may have the most well-rounded resume at the end. whether it be on surface versatility or just be, he might just have the most chances to strike in all four majors.
Yeah.
Because
I agree with that.
Do you think that's true?
Definitely out of the next gen, I've heard. I think they said on Tennis Channel that he may be like the most surface versatile on the tour. And I disagree with that. I think it's Djokovic on the ATP, but I think out of the young guys, he definitely has the best chance to really adapt to all four majors and go deep in all of them. I mean, Wimbledon, we're yet to see it, but Vaughn, you mentioned a bit of his potential on grass. I think if he can fix some of the holes in his return, that'll only help his case. I definitely like his chances on grass going forward better than Zverev's or teams as of now. So
Yeah.
I think he's got a very bright future.
Yeah. And I think it's one of the reasons why also I'm excited for the grass season. It's because last year we were robbed from this opportunity to see these young guys actually trying to do a little bit better and on that surface, especially because the years before they were just kind of developing their games, and it's a little bit more likely that they would pick on. They'll be better on hard courts or on clay courts because it's a little bit more widespread and they get more opportunities to play and to feel the surface and the bounce. But on grass, it probably takes a little bit longer to adapt and a few years of playing and seeing, so this is what happens when I do this on this court. You know? So I feel like last year would have been good to assess this, but alas, we had to wait for another year. And I'm excited to see grass court this year. Obviously, like, this is one of the reasons why. Obviously, the other reason is just because we didn't have one last year. But now that we are on clay, and we want to move on to that, you just spoke a little bit about Djokovic. Moving back to those two guys, the two big three members. And if you guys want to touch a little bit about on Roger Federer as well, like, just go full circle on the whole big three. What are their for Djokovic and Nadal specifically, does this tournament speak anything about their chances at Roland Garros?
So I'll speak a little bit on Djokovic since we already touched a bit on Nadal against Rublev. I'd say, you know, that Djokovic match was interesting to me because he came out and I've thought about this for a while with both Djokovic and Nadal, but also specifically Djokovic, that after long breaks and, you know, winning a major like he did in 2019 at the Australian Open, the rest of his, like in his Indian Wells and Miami and some of his other tournaments, he didn't seem as motivated or as engaged and willing to suffer or willing to engage in these long baseline rallies that he would if it was, you know, like a semifinals of a major, that kind of thing. But still, he came out very impressive off the gates against Jannik Sinner. And he played that really good first round, and he knew who he was up against. He had a point to prove. He, you know, he at the end convincingly beat Sinner, who was the Miami Open champ finalist. So it was a good result for him. And nobody thought he was going to lose to Dan Evans. I mean, if you had predicted Dan Evans, who has won two matches on clay, to have beaten the world number one, we would have laughed or thought you were crazy, and you would have been rich if you had bet on those based on the odds. So, but then if you actually watch the match and you look at the way Evans played it, and he played this tactically sound match where he was hitting so many slice backhands cross court, and he was forcing Djokovic to generate and come up with tough shots. And Djokovic is such a balanced, well-rounded player that it's so striking when he's off balance. I'll put it that way. And something that can do that to him is the wind. And those windy conditions that day, he was just falling back and hitting shots, or he was, you know, just pushed out of his strike zone or having to generate from really, really low, awkward balls. And he was stuck in those patterns and he couldn't really navigate his way out of the Evans slice sorcery, if you can call it that. And he wasn't getting the free points on his serve, and he wasn't able to just hit through the court and hit through the wind. And I think those kind of patterns, we have seen them in flashes before. Like if you think of the Roland Garros match against Thiem, or we've seen other one-handers kind of deploy the slice tactic against him and just force him to come up with everything and generate. And sometimes the timing isn't there and footwork, and when you haven't played for a few months. So I'm not too concerned about Djokovic, but I think it's just something to keep an eye on, that there's more players who can physically stay up to the task against him on clay and versus on hard court, where he can use other ways to get out of those long rallies. Like he can use his serve to great effect, and he can win free points on it. He can hit a lot of aces like he was in those fast courts in Melbourne. He can get more out of his forehand, I think, because he can use that space of the court, or he can redirect, which he was not able to redirect or absorb. Evans, he was having to work so hard to generate all of that on his own. And then Evans, you know, even then, you know, you still would have expected Djokovic to find a way to win a set or come out of the hole. So for him, he said it was one of his worst matches he's played in the last 4 or 5 years and on clay. And I wouldn't disagree with that. But also, I just know that he's going to get better, and he's playing in Belgrade this week. And, you know, if he plays like this in Madrid and Rome, then I'd be a little bit more concerned. But as of now, I think still, even though we might be seeing a slight decline relative to his 2011 to 2016 clay seasons, where he could absolutely outlast anybody, including Nadal in best of threes, and even at the French Open, you know, pushed him to five sets in 2013, where they had one of their best matches. If we're comparing it to those standards, then yes, you can say that it's just natural with age and with the way he's playing now to counteract that. But I think it'll be a different story, best of five sets, and still there's not many players who can beat him on clay. So,
yeah, I don't have too much to add to that. I think the result isn't too surprising. If you look at how he's done recently in Monte Carlo, he's had a string of pretty poor results there the last several years, but I was shocked to see that he lost to Evans. I think Evans did play well tactically with the slice, but Djokovic usually gets good penetration on his backhand down the line and inside and forehand, and there was just none of that. He wasn't hitting through the court enough. He hit a lot of OJ Aliassime-esque inside-out forehands that didn't really do anything, just sort of kept him locked in the rally. His serve is way less effective on clay, and it didn't do too much. And despite all of that, he was still up a break in the second, and he had a set point on which he netted an easy backhand, rally backhand, which is a collector's item. So I think I don't read too much into it because he hasn't done well at Monte Carlo since 2015. He lost to a Jiří Veselý in 2016. Right. I think 2017, did he lose to team Gofan. In 2017? Gofan, yeah. Gofan, then team 2018. Yeah. And 2019, he lost to Medvedev. So I think I think this is maybe the worst loss besides the one to Veselý. But yeah, I don't read too much into it because this hasn't been a great tournament for him for years now. So I will, I'm sure that playing in his hometown will cure whatever ails him. I think he did say he felt horrible and it was one of the worst matches he had played in a while. And I think that's a fair assessment. So.
Would you still rate Nadal as the favorite for the French Open? And yes. How high would you place him above the number two? And who is the number two, by the way? Is it Djokovic still?
Yeah.
I would agree, yeah. I have Nadal still number one. You just can't argue with his Roland Garros record.
Yeah.
And also the last time we saw him play there. And for number two, I still have Djokovic number two, but I have to see how Dominic Thiem looks. Mm-hmm. Because 2017 to 2020, he's been formidable. Probably second best at looking at Roland Garros only.
Yeah. I think if Thiem has like a great Madrid or Rome, I could maybe put him above Djokovic, but he would have to play very, very well. Nadal is the favorite by far because he's won the last four Roland Garros titles. He's only dropped three sets in the process. So he would need to have like truly, truly disastrous performances at Madrid, Rome, Barcelona, and the opening rounds of Roland Garros for me to change my mind. So I'd say Nadal, then Djokovic, then Tsitsipas, and Thiem could also leapfrog Tsitsipas depending on how strong he is in his comeback. But that's where things stand for me. What about you, Andre?
To be fair, I think Nadal is always the goal. It's like you don't go into a Roland Garros tournament with Nadal in the draw and you don't think that you don't need to beat him. Like, I mean, you always beat the player that is in front of you, as always. But at some point, you have to imagine that you might have to face Nadal. And the chances are most likely whatever 100 divided by 2 is, like in percentages. So it's like a 98% chance that you're going to have to face Nadal at Roland Garros. So it's just something that you can just imagine, oh, maybe he's going to lose this year. Like it's rare. So Nadal is definitely the favorite. Rublev did say something interesting about the pressure that he has to hold on to. Like he's been the greatest for so long that it must be such a, it would feel like such a burden for so many other players. Maybe for him, it feels like a less of a burden. Maybe he likes it. Maybe he likes that it is a burden because he likes the competition. And maybe the fact that he gets to be as competitive as it is because everybody's going to see him as the one to beat. He can play his best because people bring their best against him, which is interesting. But
And I think more of the world will be watching him this year at Roland Garros, certainly like they did last year in the fall, where it was in October when, you know, like most people were kind of, you know, all the major sports, especially in America, had already happened. And so here, and it'll be a bigger story also because he'll be going for the Grand Slam record. And last year he was tying it, but it was in the midst of, you know, so many other storylines, and tennis was in a weird place. But now with a more standard time, Roland Garros, and just the fact that he's now going to surpass Roger Federer and, you know, is the favorite there. And it just mounts every single year because he's getting older too. And it's just, and you know, it's going to be tough even for a Nadal performance. That 2020 Roland Garros final that we saw is like a top two, top three performance of like all of his 100 matches. So it's a very, very, very high bar, and margins are slim, and you just never know. That's why you follow sports, because you just don't know the outcome, even how inevitable it can be.
Yeah. And I think this year will be interesting because he is playing for 21, and on it getting harder and harder. I think score wise, it was actually easier for him in 2020 than it was in 2019. But I do think this year, like, there is some added pressure since the Roland Garros final. I know he hasn't played a match besides his World Tour Finals match with the team, I would say, where I was like really, really impressed with his level. And so, so that adds pressure.
Yeah.
I think there's a bit of additional pressure in the clay season to have a good result in the lead up, but we saw he didn't get one last year and he just played himself into form.
This Rublev thing loss that he suffered this week was pretty similar also to the Schwartzman one, where he didn't serve very well and those kind of conditions. And and he still managed to find a way and win a set here. And I think so. I think he'll only get better and better every week. I expect him to play a lot better in Barcelona.
And I think the discussion surrounding this match was very similar to the Schwartzman one. There was a lot of talk about, is he still the favorite? And I think now it's a similar situation, but he's still got three clay tournaments to play before the French. Yeah. So he has lots of time to get himself into a better position. Yeah. And even if he doesn't improve on this match, I think he'll still be the favorite. So
somebody who doesn't have a lot of time to get himself into the clay court season is Roger Federer, because he's obviously announced that he's playing in Geneva and at the French Open. And, you know, we were all wondering, I certainly was wondering, is he going to play Madrid? Is he going to play Geneva? Because we know the goal for him is Wimbledon, and obviously since that Doha run he took that time off, he didn't play Dubai, didn't play Miami, and obviously was clearly still feeling the effects physically, not at 100%. And so for him to just announce and say we're playing Geneva and Roland Garros was interesting to me, because normally Geneva is actually where Rome would have been, so he will have like a week off after the Geneva, and so I think and it'll be a lighter load for him, I think, coming back at a 250 rather than a 1,000. Yeah. But it was interesting that he didn't play Madrid, because I felt like Madrid has been his best clay court Masters out of the three. And he likes the conditions there with the altitude. But it's also not just out of the three Masters, Madrid is generally not the most conducive to what's going to happen at Roland Garros. Generally, there's big servers and who like Madrid, who like the altitude there, but it plays nothing like Roland Garros. So I think he'll try to stick with Geneva, and I think Roland Garros for him is more like the appetizer, and then Wimbledon is kind of like the main course. So that's where we're looking to see him peak and get there, but it'll just be extremely difficult. And I think Geneva will tell us a lot, because the worst thing you want to see as a Federer fan is him playing Geneva, him struggling maybe like he did in Doha, winning one match, playing, you know, really good tennis world stopping, and all eyes on him, and plays two matches and then is optimistic about it, impressed, downplays his physical fitness. And then next thing you know, 5 hours later, Roger Federer is pulled out of Roland Garros. And that would be the worst thing that for a Federer fan. Then I'd be a little bit worried that, ooh, now, you know, Wimbledon, Halle coming up, and, you know, obviously has those two memories of the two match points. And so if he can get back to any sort of rhythm, I think that's what it's going to be all about. I think, honestly, if he gets to like a round of 16 at the French Open, that's a great result right there, because that's just going to be building. And then if he loses first week, he has more time for the grass too.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, the one thing about, I think the big three in general right now, they're probably moving into this phase where I'm not sure, obviously, how much Nadal would care about like the Masters 1000 record. He probably would like to play well in at least Madrid and Rome, where he likes he just likes to play on clay. So I think he would give his all. It's not like he doesn't care about the terms that he enters in. But I do think that there is this goal of focusing on Grand Slams because that's where they play the best tournaments. That's where they feel most at home. That's where their goals, while worded differently from each of them, like it's definitely where it lies, is where it's playing well on the Grand Slams. For Djokovic, is records. For Federer, is just, I don't know, maybe the atmosphere and the fact that he loves to play in Wimbledon. And for Nadal, is probably because he thinks it's just the most competitive of the tournaments and he can be the most competitive, or something like that along those lines.
The thirst of competition.
Yeah, yeah. So I feel like it's as they all move into this season of their careers where the Grand Slams is where it's at, pretty much. I think you're going to see lots and lots of results similar to those that we see in Monte Carlo, where they're just going to play badly and just going to lose to a player outside of the top 20 or one of the younger guys in straight sets in a match that looks like it was pretty straightforward. And then they're going to come back firing back into Grand Slams, because that's where I think that they're going to put all the energy, mental and physical, into those tournaments. So that's why I totally definitely agree. Yeah, I definitely feel like all of the favoritism, if you're doing like a seeds by favorites, it would still hold that Nadal is favorite at Roland Garros. Probably Djokovic's favorite at Wimbledon. Yes. I would put Federer a second, depending on how he comes out. Like we haven't seen him since Doha, and it was encouraging, although it was not encouraging for the overall long term. But it was encouraging that he was playing well and he was not necessarily suffering from anything, it seemed. But we'll have to see and assess like how he comes back on tour. And I definitely agree with you that Vansh, that Roland Garros is definitely just an appetizer for him. There is no way that Federer is going into Roland Garros thinking I'm gonna give my all and win this tournament, because even if he does, there's a slim chance that he's gonna make it. With so many people coming up and playing really well, a newcomer on clay, Tsitsipas, playing really well too, it's just getting harder for him to get better at the tournament. Whereas Wimbledon is still a little bit like the competition is a little bit smaller in terms of players who can actually make a push to be the winner. So if there's one thing that Federer is thinking is, well, maybe Djokovic and Nadal are going to lose early again as well. And maybe I have a better shot of winning against Tsitsipas and team than I have with the other guys. So
you mentioned Federer and Roland Garros. It's interesting because now he's eighth in the world. And so he could,
get one of them in the quarters. That'd be
exactly
interesting.
And even at Wimbledon, actually, because Wimbledon doesn't use the seeding formula anymore. They got rid of that in 2020. So he'll be seeded whatever his ranking is at Wimbledon as well.
Yeah, I do wonder if it would affect the matchup at all if he like got Djokovic in a quarterfinal instead of a final. I think probably not, because Djokovic tends to do a great job of like peaking mentally and physically against Federer and Nadal. But it'd be interesting to see them play in a Wimbledon quarterfinal instead of the final.
Yeah. And speaking of favorites for Roland Garros, we had a big announcement from Thiem, who was posting on an interview that he gave that he was kind of struggling to find his drive to play tennis and to, you know, find the motivation to go on court and do his best or practice, something along those lines. First of all, it's definitely a fair assessment. He mentioned winning after the U.S. Open and just kind of having this this little low on energy on energy in terms of going out and striving for more. And to be fair, like when you play as a tennis player and you practice your entire life pretty much to win those tournaments and you get to win one, it's, I think Owen, you said it was pretty cathartic in a way, which. In a way, it definitely shows how the big three have this crazy, weird obsession or drive to play tennis above all else and keep coming in and out, week in and week out, and month in, month out, year in and year out, playing their best tennis and winning slams like it's 250s, like it's challengers. But for him, it's definitely something like you get to that point and you win. So. And I mean, there's definitely some letdown in that one. But I do think this compromises his favoritism in Roland Garros.
I think it can. I'd like to say first that I think this phenomenon is very normal. Like you said, the big three and Serena and all the other people who've won like tons of majors, I think have an incredibly rare characteristic where they're just able to be consistently sustained by success. I think Andre Agassi and Caroline Wozniacki have both spoke about how they felt nothing when they reached world number one. And they had to like come up with new goals and find new ways to motivate themselves. And that can be really difficult. Like with team, he said he worked for 15 years to achieve this goal, and then he did. And like you said, it's incredibly cathartic. So sort of how do you keep your motivation at the same level? I think there would be, for 99.999% of the people in the world, there would be an inevitable dip after that, because how do you sustain it having reached the mountaintop? You have to look for new mountaintops. And so I think results are more relevant than these quotes, but I think the quotes are definitely consistent with maybe that it's taken him a little longer to come back, that he's having maybe some struggles besides just his physicality. So I think, I do think it puts his favoritism at tournaments into question a little bit. I'd like to see him come back because he's a spectacular player. He has really exciting rivalries with Nadal and Djokovic and Tsitsipas. So I'd love to see him back and playing his best in time for the French Open, or even before then, if possible.
Yeah, I mean, his interview was quite honest, and it was brave of him to, talk about mental health struggles. And, you know, that's something that, not many athletes willingly or openly share. And so it was good to see that it's not just physically. Obviously, he's been compromised with his knees and his foot, but then also now now mentally also he's kind of struggling to build on that US Open run and those expectations. And I think Owen's right, it's completely normal, and it's these three that we have are kind of a rare breed in that sense, but also it just speaks to how much work team put in to get to that point, to actually hold that US Open. Just the amount of tournaments I remember him playing from, basically 2016 to 2020, and the whole pandemic year, he was playing, nonstop. Like he played something like 29 matches, between March 2020 and August 2020, where the rest of the tour was training and taking or resting or recuperating or taking a break. And to me, it's no surprise that he has had somewhat of a letdown, and that his season didn't quite, he had that fantastic win over Kyrgios, but since then it's been really tough to see him. He's been a little bit of a shell of himself the last 2-3 matches since. But I think it's good that he's recognized this early. He's now taking a break, and I think he'll come back stronger and hungrier. He also said that his goal is still to win the French Open, and he also mentioned the Olympics as being a big goal, because his coach Nicolas Massou prides himself as that was his biggest accomplishment, was winning the 2004 Olympic gold for his country in Chile, and also winning the doubles at the same time. And so playing for his country and playing for finding that new mountaintop, like Owen was talking about, is going to be key. And there's plenty of them, and he's a great player already. It's so natural for him, Clay. So I think it'll be interesting to see how he adjusts. And it shows. And he's what, 27, and he'll be 28 in September. So I think, while he's no longer young anymore, but I think I still think he has plenty of really good years ahead.
Yeah, yeah, he's not young, but he's not yet old. So I think there's still plenty of time.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about the I think this meeting is, if you want to do like 10 more minutes.
Stupid Zoom is going to kick us out again. Yeah. I'll start one more meeting and we can do like 10 minutes on that.
Yeah. I was thinking of like maybe I would just finish it because I have to go soon as well. So
okay, sure, yeah. On the next one, we can catch up with that stuff some more if you want.
Yeah, for sure.
That'd be interesting. Sure.
Especially because Billie Jean King only finishes like next year anyway, so we have plenty of time.
Okay, yeah. So there's time.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
So yeah, thank you guys so much for being here. It was a great talk. I'm as always really, really excited to watch the next few tournaments that are coming about, and we'll see how our assessments of the players come about. If they come true or not. Obviously, Roland Garros is still a bit of a long way ahead. So we'll stick to Barcelona now and see how Nadal does there and the other players. I'm excited to see a couple of the Canadians coming back as well. And you probably are excited to see some of the Americans. On that note, thank you all for listening. Follow us on Twitter. All of our handles are in the description. And I'll see you guys later. Bye-bye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.